for over 8 minutes, people watched a man die. This wasn't hearing about it after the fact. This wasn't reading about it. This was a video that showed a human being begging for his life, calling for his mom, and dying while a white police officer knelt on his neck as casually as if he were just, you know, selecting a soda off a shelf.
Syracuse, like many other cities across the U.S., has been the scene of large, emotional, and diverse protests over police treatment of people of color and the underlying policies that support embedded racism. Thanks for listening to this special Syracuse Speaks edition on protests, police policies, and progress. I'm WAER News and Public Affairs Director Chris Bolt. What have the rallies and marches told us about our community and how well it's addressed racism in policing in other areas? What specifically needs to happen in policies and laws in order to achieve more justice? And how can both protest and community leaders take the energy of the moment and turn it into lasting change? These are some of the things we're going to talk about. And with me on our Syracuse Speaks panel today are Yusuf Abdul-Qadir with the New York Civil Liberties Union, the director of the local chapter, who's been a speaker at local rallies and involved in these issues for a long time. Thanks for joining us, Yusuf.
Thank you.
We have Pastor Eric Uhr of the Promised Land Church, who's organized rallies and meetings of urban clergy with city officials. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Sam Rouser, Executive Director of On Point for College, helping bring opportunity to many inner city youth who are struggling against inequality and often can be victims of racism and violence. Sam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We wanted to get started by talking about the protests and rallies and marches that we're seeing in our community and really across the nation. And I really just wanted to start with, all of you have either been part of something, you've certainly or helped organize, you've spoken at these events or been part of them viscerally. What are you seeing happen when you've been on the streets, and what's the feeling like for you, especially if you're one of the organizers of this event? Maybe Pastor Uhr will start with you.
Well, what I've been seeing interacting with people as they've come out to protest from all walks of life and all sections of Onondaga County and the city in particular is people are mad and frustrated that this issue of inappropriate actions by the police, violence towards people of color, is still an issue that has not been properly addressed and properly eliminated in our culture and in our society. For all that we say about being united as the United States and the home of the free, the land of the brave, etc., there still remains this troubling issue regarding violence that is perpetrated on people by police.
I guess I'll probably be the odd man out here because I have not gone to one of the rallies. I've not been downtown. I've not marched. And it's been a little bit of a conscious decision. The level of frustration that I feel, and, you know, I talked about it a little bit in a post where, you know, for some people, this is their first time seeing this thing and they're energetic. And for other people, you know, here we go again. This particular situation seems to have taken on a different face, though. There's a different feeling, a different mood. It's a different level of positivity that's coming out of this. But I've not gone to any marches. I've been talking to a lot of people, been engaging our alumni on how they can support the efforts and what they can do to participate. And they've been doing some really productive things and been able to watch some of them on TV, even speaking out. But it's a different feeling going on right now.
And Yusuf, what are you seeing and feeling as you've been part of these events?
You know, I want to take a moment to, you know, acknowledge what you just said, Sam, because I don't think there should be a judgment placed on you. Not that I think you think that that's the case, for not participating in these sets of protests, because it's important to understand, and I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but as a black man as well, that this is not new to us. This is a part of a long history. And I think sometimes we want to look at the moment as if it's, you know, separate from a stream of issues. I mean, last year, Nicole, God, I can't believe I'm forgetting her name, but, you know, she works at the New York Times magazine, and she created really an important discussion around the history of when enslaved Africans were first brought to America's shores, right? The 1619 Project.
Right.
Nicole Hannah-Jones. in that discussion, it's essential for us to not separate this moment from that long struggle of 401 years. Mm-hmm. 401 years of a system that has ensured the maintenance of white supremacy. And I think it's difficult for people to appreciate and understand that, but this moment doesn't exist in abstract of that longer narrative, that longer conversation. And so when you express that you cannot participate because this is not new to you, I think that's acceptable fundamentally because for Black people, this is a part of a long legacy. And I want to piece out between, what we're seeing in policing as an institution, which emerged out of the maintenance of that system of white supremacy, either from being overseers and then later slave catchers and then later people who beat people with billy clubs to maintain segregation. And as we've seen the proliferation of mass incarceration, the maintenance of this duality of a system that will always subjugate Black people. And so what I appreciate from those who organize, I want to give a shout out to the people who did the work to do these protests and these rallies. I would be remiss if I didn't mention them. The organizers of Last Chance for Change, who are not what people perceive to be the seasoned professionals in this regard. The youth of CUSE Youth BLM, who worked with Raja Syracuse and the local BLM chapter to organize a 2,000-plus rally this weekend, which was empowering because what differentiated it from the civil rights movement is that it wasn't just Black people talking about these issues. It was a sea of diversity of issues.
How are you seeing that this is affecting people now? As you've mentioned, there's been protests in the past. These issues are in no way new. They go back 400 years, but in terms of activism around them, they go back 60 years. There have been different events in the country and that we've seen massively, whether it was Freddie Gray or Eric Gardner or Michael Brown. Are you hearing things different? Pastor Yura, when you talk to people, is this a little bit of a different moment than those? It's captured the whole country, even other countries.
Well, the atrocities done to people of color, in particular African Americans in America, is not new. But I think one of the things you have to think about is technology and the way media and news is spread. I had a conversation with my 16-year-old, and I never imagined in my lifetime I have a discussion with her about watching someone murdered on her cell phone. So when you think about media and what media can connect us to now as opposed to what's happened in the past, it's no wonder that people are concerned, angry, and frustrated on such a wide level because it's not just exposure in local news. It's exposure in global news. It's exposure when people are, because of COVID-19, are at home and on lockdown. So they're in front of their TVs or on some piece of social media. So many more people are witnessing with their outrage what's going on. And I think that's been a bigger call to action than what we've seen in the past.
And you mentioned young people. Is it affecting, I know, Sam, you work with a lot of young people. Is this affecting at this time in space, maybe technology and social media has something to do with it, is it affecting young people in a different way perhaps than in the past?
Well, I don't know if it's a different way. One of the other things I want to say is that the activism really didn't just start 60 years ago. It started 400 years ago. Harriet Tubman was an activist. Mr. Brown was an activist. I mean, we've been fighting this battle for 400 years, and it's been a nonstop thing. The young people now, they are affected, and they're a little baffled at what's going on and why things are happening the way that they are. And we have a generation now, at least when I look at my children, that they don't just ask the question why, but they want to make the change and they want the change to happen now. My daughter graduated last year and is working kind of what I say is her first real job. And she doesn't understand what this start at the bottom of the totem pole means. She's like, no, I want equal rights to everyone else that's here. Matter of fact, we should all share in ownership of this company. Why does one person, because they've been there longer, get to own more than everyone else? And so the thought process is really different. So the impact of when they don't feel something is right is different, and their response is different.
Hmm. Now, I mentioned this thing where there have been rallies in other countries far afield, whether it's New Zealand, European countries, et cetera. Is there a reason? And again, maybe it's some of these same reasons. But is there a reason that this moment in time, these incidents as they've risen, have grabbed that kind of attention.
You know, there's a genius to how the civil rights movement, and I want to be clear, because this is not, this also use of modern technology and modern communication technology in particular is not a new tactic in the liberation of black people. The civil rights movement was really explicit with making sure to do nonviolent peaceful protesting to demonstrate to the public in America, but also the world, to shock, explicitly shock the consciousness of people, to show that the way with which the brutality was brought upon them was reprehensible and antithetical to the American values and ideals that we espoused around the world as we were fighting in a Cold War. And so it was the use of modern telecommunications, the use of television as a medium, which was really new at that time, to demonstrate and show the hosing of people, the attacking of people from dogs, etc. What makes this distinct, though, and different is that we do live in an interconnected global economy, and that interconnected global economy has had several, reverberations. And so when you talk about young people, I like to think I'm one of those young people. I'm 33. So
absolutely.
You know, I still fall in that category.
You got me beat.
You're only 35. And so when you think about young people, we grew up in a moment, you know, many of us grew up either as middle school students or as people, some of which were just born and 9/11, right? Then you had the collapse of the global economic system, right? The financial crisis of 2008. Then you had the banks being bailed out and the promise of going to college and getting a good job being impossible. And it took 10 years for us to get to the point where we kind of almost recovered. Mm-hmm. And then you had COVID-19, which really showed manifest the fissures in our society and the inequities in our society. And it showed explicitly clear that we actually really haven't addressed those issues in any really robust way. And so then we had another economic crisis of which we are still reeling from. There's 16% unemployment right now. And so all of these promises that we're told, we're seeing that actually the bill of goods never come to sale. Mm-hmm. That we keep continuously getting told that if you follow this process, that this will be the outcome, and it never actually happens. You can get your education, you can get your bachelor's, you can get your master's, and you can still be working at McDonald's. Mm-hmm. And this is not to diminish people who work at McDonald's. I value all types of labor and all people on the spectrum of labor. But when you are told that there's a promise that your generation will be better than the previous generation, and we're seeing that the statistics tells us that that's not the case, it's evidently clear that it only is going to change if we are going to be the ones who fight for our future. Mm-hmm. Because unfortunately, many have become so complacent with the status quo that they're not willing to put themselves at risk or perceivably at risk to make that change. And this is a part of why all of these things together, with a constant barrage of these images, the constant inaction, the constant bouts of proliferation in the country of gun violence, where we're seeing people shooting in schools, where we're seeing all these problems, and no real action from the people whose job it is literally to make action. In fact, explicit inaction from them.
You are a reflection of your leadership. I mean, if the leadership doesn't lead, then the people are left to lead themselves, and then you have the chaos of everyone trying to make their own decision and go their own way. And what we have now is a vacuum of leadership at the top. We have someone that's really stroking the chaos that as it erupts and would love it to be more chaotic. They grow and prosper from that. And so we have to really be prepared to fight against it. We have to see it. We have to understand it. And we have to react accordingly.
Well, and maybe as that gets more, I don't know, stark, the reactions are more quick to that kind of division. And, it's no secret that even at the anybody in Washington, these people are butting heads on everything, and certainly anything that has to do with race immediately becomes very, very challenging. Leaders at the top can't agree on anything to help, and it trickles down very, very quickly. Let me shift gears just a little bit real quickly. One last comment about what went on or what has been going on in rallies and marches is the diversity. Now, that's what we're kind of reporting on, but that's my point of view from my biases and what I'm seeing. But in the crowd on Saturday, in some of the marches, I'm seeing ethnic diversity as the easiest one, but there's a tremendous amount of age diversity. And I'm just wondering if you make note of that as being different from other movements, other actions that we've seen here and nationally.
You know, I think that I think it's important to recognize and acknowledge the amount of ethnic diversity, racial diversity, gender identity diversity. That is essential, but I don't want to take away from the fact that the people whose voices have been centered in this work right now, and actually which is remarkably impressive, are the young people, particularly young Black people. When I watched Saria Rahim speaking, it was powerful. When I heard Shukri's, you know, poetry, it was powerful. When I heard Talana Jones speak about ableism, it was powerful. When I heard Nikita talking about what are we at stake in this moment, it was powerful. And I do think that, yes, there were certainly people in the audience who were diverse. There were a variety of backgrounds. But what I appreciated most is that it centered Black issues with Black people, with Black voices. And I think that when we are able to do that, because we are the best to articulate our struggle. And I think oftentimes people want to reduce our struggle and try to compartmentalize our struggle for us, when we are actually the best suited to tell our story.
And it's important to understand that, you know, nothing is going to change overnight, over the weekend, and over a couple months. It's going to be a process, but it can't be words. It can't be, you know, everyone's put out a statement now to say they support Black Lives Matter. It's not what you say, it's what you do. And what we need to see is, what is your action plan? And it can't just be in one area. Yes, we need criminal justice reform. Absolutely. They policed us for 400 years to maintain this condition. We also need educational reform. We need curriculum change. That is, if we teach, we're teaching everyone to react the way that everyone's acting now. And we start that in kindergarten, really in preschool on up. Those things have to change. Economic, it's great to get everyone a job, because some people don't want to be owners, but ownership is critical. And we have to be able to talk on all platforms about what the change is that needs to happen. And it has to be a continuous flow. I was reminded that the Montgomery bus boycott lasted 381 days. That's over a year, that they've been battling in Ferguson for over 400 days. It's not something that's going to happen instantaneously. People have to be prepared to stay.
Absolutely. Sustainability is critical. But speaking to the diversity, it's good to bring many people to the table, because what it does is it diversifies the outrage. It is a Black issue, but more than Black people are outraged by what they've seen. So when we think in terms of Black Lives Matter, All Lives Matter, you know, I rationalized to my children. I said, when a human being murdered another human being. Then I had another conversation. Well, it was a white human being that murdered a Black human being. But it was two conversations, but needed to be held on both levels so we could understand complete outrage, why we need to do something on a human level to bring about the change that we need to bring about. And it is going to take sustainability, and it's going to take everybody coming together. But I think, you know, in terms of short-term goals and long-term goals, one of the short-term things I've seen that count as success is finally the four officers that were involved in George's murder were actually brought up on charges.
Right.
You know, in Buffalo just recently, those two officers that pushed that senior white gentleman to the ground were brought up on charges of felony assault. And I believe that as we are organizing more, some of that was because of everybody's attempt to have some kind of voice of outrage. So almost organized chaos of coming together created a system of pressure where people said, we can't just put this back in the drawer. We can't just be silent about this. Someone was killed. Police abusing their authority. Someone got pushed to the ground, cracked his head on the sidewalk and bleeding out of his ears right on social media, right on TV, right in front of us. Some action has to be taken about that. And people have done that. But, I said to my churches on the Sunday, you know, an arrest is not a conviction. An arrest is not a prison sentence. So the movement cannot stop here. It's got to keep going until justice is finally done.
All right, great. Thanks for your thoughts on those things. Coming up, just about everyone has seen or heard impassioned speeches at protests and rallies marking a history of injustice. What laws or policies can people demand and help usher in that would lead to real change? This is Syracuse Speaks on WAER.
I've done everything else I can think of. I've donated to bail funds that are helping the protesters and made some connections to offer assistance where I can. I've been really active on social media on these issues. I tried to speak at a city budget hearing to advocate for reductions in the police budget and shifting those funds to the community, committing to make this a voting priority for me, going from something I check positions on and factor in to just straight up a requirement to get my vote, and then engaging with family and friends more directly and more bluntly than I have in the past.
Since the coronavirus pandemic began, we've heard from so many of you that in this uncertain time, listening to WAER and NPR is familiar. We want you to know that WAER remains committed to being here for you, and we hope our program schedule brings you comfort and entertainment as well as the latest news. If you consider WAER a vital service, there couldn't be a better time to support us than right now. Please give securely at WAER.org.
I think it's important to change laws, not just at the federal level, but city and state. So much of this change happens locally, and people pay more attention to federal elections, obviously. You know, and not only when I say change the laws, we got to change the people making the laws, because they've had a lot of opportunities to get something done already, and they haven't. But it takes time for things to change. It's been 6 years since Ferguson, and a couple of days ago, they elected the first black mayor in the history of the city, the first female mayor in the history of the city.
This is Syracuse Speaks on WAER. We're talking about racism and injustice, how embedded it is in policing and other policies. And now we want to move into concrete steps that can be taken. With me is Pastor Eric Uhr of Promised Land Church, Sam Rouser with On Point for College, and Yusuf Abdul Qadir of the New York Civil Liberties Union. And right now, I wanted to play some comments that have been made by Syracuse Mayor Ben Walsh regarding what's been going on in terms of the city's aspect and response to making police policies work in a way that can be both just or say, more just. Mayor Walsh addressed the protests and his reaction to both the events, but also the underlying issues.
We are really focused on, again, getting at those root causes of why people are protesting, talking about systemic racism, talking about inequality, really difficult conversations that we need to be having, that as an administration and as a city we have been having.
He also addressed specifically some of the police policies that are at the center of the current and ongoing controversy, and he took some credit for having made some progress.
You're seeing conversations around the country, and a lot of people are hitting me up on social media saying, hey, you need to look at your use of force policy. I'm proud to say that we did do that without having to be called out on social media. Chief Buckner came in, that was on the top of his list, and we did that. We made sure that it emphasized things like valuing the sanctity of human life, the importance of de-escalation, the importance of duty to intercede for other officers.
So he identifies some of the top issues and seems to be open for at least considering change in any of them. What are you guys hearing?
Yeah, this is an interesting discussion. I want to, again, center how policy actually gets changed, because I think we, as a person deeply rooted in policy work, I would push back on what the mayor represents as a kind of affirmative response to addressing these issues. The NYCLU litigated against Syracuse Police Department and the city of Syracuse because the city of Syracuse used tasers in two instances, of which is a case called Epps-Hanks v. the city of Syracuse, where they shot a taser at two children in Syracuse City Schools. That caused a settlement agreement to result in a change in the taser use policy, and the broader use of force policy was still problematic. We then litigated again a few years ago because a police officer put a 15-year-old in a chokehold in the similar type of maneuver that was done to Eric Garner, which resulted in his death. And that 15-year-old, which was his 15th birthday, I need to be clear, because the day before he was 14, this was his 15th birthday, the first few weeks of high school. He lost consciousness, had a gash from one side of his chin to the other, and Syracuse use of force policy changed accordingly. Now, I'm concerned because I think the representation is that the work is done. Last year, almost about this time last year, there was an incident that arose where Shaunlin Moore was pulled out of a vehicle and, as was reported by the chief, had a low-density punch to the head. I'm not exactly sure what a low-density punch is, but he had a low-density punch to the head. And I saw he got punched in the head, but a low density punch to the head in a video that had gone viral for his music being too loud and right. asking the question as to why being stopped. Subsequently, about a week or so later, there was a lawsuit where the city was settled, basically determined that they need to pay $1 million to a use of force, excessive force case. And there were about 5 use of force cases in the news at that moment, one of which was the death of an elderly man, Mr. Watkins. That galvanized about 600 people to show up to St. Lucie's Church, mm-hmm. whereby we, the NYCLU, SPARC, which is Syracuse Police Accountability and Reform Coalition, a local kind of public advocacy think tank that works in support of organizers on these issues, provided an 18-page analysis of Syracuse's new use of force policy, which stressed that it was inadequate. That, yes, it talks about sanctity of life, mm-hmm. but the language with which it uses is not adequate. Yes, it talks about the officer's requirement and duty to intercede, but the language is not explicit. That analysis not only compared those two things, but also the entire policy, looked at policies across the country, showed what the best practices were, listed out what the language should look like, and it was 18 pages. Mm-hmm. They've had that since June 20-something of last year. Right. That policy hasn't changed.
Right. So the amount of credit to be taken has to be put into the proper context of how that change came about and that it is in no way work that's undone. Eric, Sam, do you have reactions to what the mayor said in terms of do you hear an open, I don't know, ear to change or a little bit of, I don't know, dissemination?
Well, from the perspective of our congregants and congregations and coalition of pastors, when we talk about these issues to present to the mayor, to the police chief, when we meet with them, you know, there's just no sense of clarity as to the wording seems ambiguous, especially to a non-legal person. You know, I'm a lay person, too. I don't have a law degree, but not law. But it seems ambiguous. And then what are the consequences? And then if the consequences are meant to be used as an effective tool, why is there still so much abuse by the police force?
You know, and kind of what I mentioned a little earlier is that, you know, you come out with all these statements, or you can call them policies. Now we have these policies that say you can't do these and policies that say you can't do that. We've had laws and rules and regulations for 400 right. years. And you can make whatever law or whatever policy you want, but you can't change the heart of the individual who's going to manipulate that policy or manipulate that procedure. So as we're talking about, changing the policy and making sure that we have the correct terminology and we have the correct way of doing things, we have to look at the people that we're putting out there. And to me, that it goes to the heart of the education system that we have here. Mm-hmm. We have an antiquated education system that's outdated, and it has to change. It has to the curriculums have to change to teach people that, you know, one person is not necessarily better than another person. So if even if you have the best policy that you possibly can, if the person behind that policy, I mean, we have a president that interprets things one way and they're totally different from the way that I interpret things. But we're following the same policy, but there's going to be right. a different outcome. And so we've got to work hard on the hearts and minds of people that we're entrusting mm-hmm. with this. Our students are looking at this and they're like, you know, why can't I say what I feel? Why can't I express my thoughts? Why do I have to limit who I am in order to appease someone because of the uniform that they wear? Mm-hmm. That respect has to be mutual.
Let's just move on real quickly. Police Chief Kenton Buckner has had the backs of his officers to some degree, especially talking about how they've responded to recent protests and marches and rallies in terms of using a certain amount of restraint. He also gives some attention to reform of force policies and perhaps a little less so to accountability measures, whether that's officer conduct records, how complaints are handled, and lead to any discipline. Let's listen what he had to say.
The first thing we want to have is that the officer clearly understand what's expected of him or her in that moment. That's what the training is for. The other part of that is that we must have accountability measures in place, that when we misstep, that we review that thoroughly, that we document the information, and then I make the appropriate decisions about the officer's behavior. So when we saw what has taken place in Minneapolis, we immediately began to scan our policies on use of force, our policies on how we engage the public, what tactics we use to physically restrain individuals, to make sure that our people understand what's expected of them and that we're not making similar mistakes.
I had asked Police Chief Buckner that question about, you know, when you see something like Minneapolis, so egregious example of force and just tragic that we all saw. And, you know, there's multiple angles. There's no way to get around what happened there. If they, in fact, use that as a moment to say, hey, you know, what are we doing? Is there a place that we can perhaps close gaps or whatever? He's sort of implicitly suggesting that Syracuse officers should be more aware of correct policies, where the lines are, et cetera. Any of you reacting to how the police force is operating now and again, how open they are to change at this moment?
Again, my lay opinion and what I've been reading, and as more of these things come to light, even in light of discussion here at Syracuse locally, I want to put in perspective what we experienced, we saw in the newspaper, what happened with the Buffalo police officers. They were part of what's called an ERT, emergency response team. And after the two officers were arrested and charged with felony assault, the other members of the team resigned. And the article said that they resigned from the ERT because the union was no longer guaranteeing that they would back them as far as if they get into different kinds of controversy with the community, and which had normally been their policy. And then the other concern they had was usually it seemed to be that if a police officer in the performance of their professional performance of their duty got in some kind of legal bind, the city will provide for attorney. But these two men are being required to furnish their own attorneys. So for those reasons, everyone else resigned from the ERT team. Now, that caused me as a citizen to say, I don't understand why you wouldn't continue to volunteer for something that emergency response team, because it seems like your blanket protection to act how you want to act in all situations, irregardless of your conduct, is being taken away. And if that was your only protection or incentive or your safety blanket to interact with no impunity, then I'm very concerned about the mentality that police have when they go into police situations. So along those lines, I bring that back to Syracuse is that, again, with the use of force policy, one of the other things that needs to be addressed along with that is what kind of protection will be afforded by the union? Well, what does the city do to protect the officer if they were in some kind of controversial situation? And I think, again, all that needs to be addressed so that, again, the officer has to have a same level of accountability we're expected to have. I'm responsible for my own actions when I interact with people.
I'll break down some of the specific policy ideas here in a minute, but just Sam or Yusuf, hearing the police chief, what sense do you get of where Syracuse is? And if they're sort of nimble and can look at a Minnesota, Minneapolis situation and then say, hey, here's an area where we can close a gap or improve a policy.
Again, I think it's in the heart. You know, I remember having a conversation at one of the events last year. The police chief and some of the officers, they came out in the community and they kind of talked to the community about the things that were going on in Syracuse. And one of the concerns that the community had was, you know, that officers can shoot someone, can kill someone. And the response was kind of like, well, you have more individuals in the community killing people than you have officers killing people. That justification or that lining those two things up are not equal, because the difference is that people in the community, if they take a life, they pay a penalty.
Right.
The officers pay no penalty when they take a life. You can't compare those two together. So the way that we think about their actions has to be different.
Right.
It's even more egregious because you can. It's not just that they won't pay a penalty. They can be given an award. What I just want to be very brief to say that we have to recognize that these policies exist in an ecosystem of policies. So you can't train away some of these things. And I think we have this desire to say, well, if we just had adequate training, policies matter. right? Policies matter, right? They do matter. They have meaning. And it's not just the use of force policies. It's the union contract. The union contract creates a situation whereby it affords certain offenses to not be perceived to be fireable, which means that even if the chief wanted to, because it's a collective bargaining agreement, if the chief determined that this was a behavior that wasn't constituted within the union contract, he actually doesn't have that authority because of those issues. And I think that we need to see these ecosystem of policies and recognize that it's not just the use of force policy, which is why I don't want the conversation to get narrowed to police officers. Because when you distill it down to police, it gets into very difficult, murky territory. It's about the institution of policing. Mm-hmm. And what the institution of policing facilitates is for these outcomes to happen. They're protected by New York State Law 50A. They're protected by union contracts. They're protected by use of force policies. They're funded by cities that have high concentrations of poverty like Syracuse. They're perpetuated in their authority to engage in their behavior because we've given them license. And I'm happy you mentioned the distinction between gun violence and community. I'm not going to use black on black crime. I just find that an offensive term, ridiculous. I don't want to hear it. I am, though, going to talk about the distinction between gun violence in communities that is a public health crisis, that is a response to issues of poverty that we're using law enforcement to respond to. The challenge is when you had a school district that suspended people for decades to such a point that many haven't gotten a high school diploma, we have not had economic opportunities for those individuals. I'm not excusing people to be able to engage in drug trade. I'm saying I understand and empathize because I've had opportunities that other people just didn't have. And that facilitates for the response that we have. In the case of Mr. Watkins, an elderly man who had other health issues, mental health issues, I believe also potentially dementia, we responded to that crisis with law enforcement when there should have been other people who responded to that crisis. And he was killed. My stepfather has dementia. My brother has a traumatic brain injury. My stepfather is Puerto Rican, but he's an Afro-Latino. So he's not going to be able to be calm in that circumstance. Mm-hmm. He's going to be erratic because that is the nature, the manifestation of his disability. And so what we're saying is it's his responsibility to be calm, cool, and collected, not the person who has training, not the person who we trust with a gun, not the person who's the paid professional. I think that's absurd.
What concretely could change in terms of a law that somebody votes on that actually makes a change in how much, you know, power or influence that contract or that union has?
Two things that are really simple. Well, I'm going to say two, but there's probably like 15. First, people should actually be able to see the union contract. I've seen the union contract. It's deplorable. There are handwritten notes on it on margins of the page. No contract should look like that because the city is negotiating against its own interests. This is not something that hasn't – this is not the first time that people have said this. People have been saying this for a long time. In fact, in a public setting with 600 people last year, I said it. And the union contract, just like the teacher's union contract, should be on a website where people can see so that people can understand what – are the collecting bargaining agreements that the city is affording the police department.
Absolutely.
Second thing, we want to often talk about diversity and people having to live in the city. That is not – it's a good step. It's not the solution to the broader systemic issues. Of course, we have to have a more diversified force. Of course, we have to have a force where there's a residency requirement. But when we talk about reforming the union contract and we limit it to those two things without dealing with the fact that a person could be a serial rapist and that may not be an offense that is fireable, that's a problem. When we distill and reduce the reform of the union contract to just having more black and brown people and having people live in the city, that's a bone that we're giving to people. That's actually not adequate enough. We have to have a radical change in how we understand the role of policing in our community as a public safety force. Because quite frankly, there are many times that people of color don't feel safe. They just don't. And that's a fact.
And if I could just add just one little piece to that. And the policing part is only a part of that situation because after the police have pulled me over for next to nothing and because I questioned them about it, they've given me tickets. And now I got to go to court and explain to the judge, well, you know, you got a ticket for this, for something hanging in your window? Yeah, isn't that stupid? You must have been a butthole to the police officer. Huh? So now what are you getting ready to do to me? And so I want to just stay away from the whole system, because the whole system, not just the police part of it, but even the criminal justice part of it, is against me. And I'm there alone. I'm the only one in the court that looked like me.
And we wonder why we have high levels of concentrated poverty.
Right. Another issues, exactly. It just doesn't have the we're going to talk about real reform and change in policing. Again, it is a high level just talking about just the police and their actions, but legislation, the collective bargaining agreement, and then, you know, we have a citizens review board in Syracuse, but we've looked into many times what real power do they have to investigate and resolve issues and problems, little to none. And that's been a systemic problem that's been going on for the almost 20 plus years I've been living in Syracuse, and it still hasn't changed because the heart and will to do it has not been there. I think it's time to address all of those issues.
The governor, I mean, while we're on legislation and that kind of reform, the governor has this Say Their Name proposal, which includes banning chokeholds, criminalizing false race-based 911 reports. Where someone might come in and there's nothing going on, but they just make a call or make a claim that some, you know, racial violence is going on, and then sort of something comes out of nothing, maybe similar to the incident that happened in Central Park with the gentleman who was birdwatching and asked a woman to move her dog out of that area, and all of a sudden, you know, it kind of escalated very quickly. And then the other thing is the 50A law that you mentioned, Yusuf. Since this is being addressed on that level, I mean, we're talking about the city level, but this is the state level. Is that a kind of legislation that could trickle down and have real impacts?
Well, you know, I'll just say it this one time. I don't usually say it. I've been around, you know, 61 years. And
Black,
you know,
truly don't crack.
and you know, the experience of not wanting to get into an argument with anyone because they might call the police. Well, not wanting to get in an argument with white people because they might call the police on you. And it could be about anything, any trivial thing. Mm-hmm. This is something that's ingrained in our society. We're just now seeing it, but this has been a lifelong experience that if you go into the store and they treat you, and as a kid growing up, and I grew up on Wood Ave on the South Side, and you know, you go into a store, and if Mr. Ed said, you know, get out my store, you just got out. You didn't stay in and try to buy something, because if he called the police, you were in trouble. It didn't matter if you, it was no right or wrong. You're always wrong. And it's wrong from the police, it's wrong through the criminal justice system. So it's good to hear that. You know, for me, after 60 years, that they might, you know, institute a policy that says you can't call the police on black people for being black.
Right.
sounds good.
We mean whether that's enforceable or how that actually looks like on the ground.
Will they implement it? Because the person who comes to that scene gets to make that determination if you're being called on, because, and if you don't have video, did it really happen?
But it speaks to the times we live in where, you know, you have to be concerned about, and we need a law that can keep somebody from weaponizing their race. Because the tragic thing about the Central Park incident was, at that time, that woman, she weaponized her race. Fortunately for the gentleman that was bird watching, he had his own footage, his own camera, his own coverage, so his own story to tell. But if he hadn't had that support, it could have gone a dramatic other way.
Sure.
Which I understand why, and it was frustrating to her why she got the repercussions that she did. That she lost her job, people were protesting about her. She weaponized her race. And it's something, we live in a society where we need laws to protect people of color from people of non-color weaponizing their race.
And just to describe, in this case, if this law passed, it would criminalize that kind of report on the basis of who just called, because they were trying to sort of race bait in that case. Yusuf, can I ask you really quickly to just briefly go over the 50A civil rights law and, you know, what a change would do there, because that has been sort of a shield of misconduct.
Yeah, I'll address that. I want to just 5 seconds say I would be careful about creating new criminal statutes because of what it can do. Whenever we create new criminal statutes, it's almost always used against black people.
Yes.
So I think we really, a law that's supposed to be about hate crimes against black people often will probably be used against black people. So I think we should be really careful with creating new criminal statutes. That said, 50A is a police secrecy law. It's a law that enables police personnel records to be shielded. The audacity of this law, it's called civil rights law, where if an officer engages in misconduct, whatever that misconduct could be, their disciplinary record, as it has been interpreted, could not be revealed to demonstrate that we have a repeat offender. The officer, Officer Gavin, I believe, Chauvin, I think is his name.
Yeah, Chauvin, Derek Chauvin. Yeah,
Officer Chauvin, who murdered Mr. Floyd in Minnesota, had 18 offenses against him, previous offenses including discharging his firearm. And if this were New York State, his disciplinary record would be shielded from the public to be able to see that this officer is a repeated offender. And so this is a problem because it impedes on the public's ability to have trust in law enforcement and impedes on the public's ability for accountability.
The other side of that is we have to stop, and this is you know, the media's role in it. We have to stop letting the system criminalize the victim. You know, if I'm a victim of something that happens, don't go and say, well, you know, 20 years ago, right, Sam Rauser got arrested for marijuana, you know, or he had marijuana in his pocket. Like that somehow just, we've got to change that narrative, and we got to stop letting other people set the narrative for us.
Well, that's a good time to change into just the next thing we wanted to talk about. Coming up, the past weekend saw a huge downtown rally, marches, and other events in many neighborhoods, and even in very non-diverse towns and villages. How can all the energy and recognition of these intractable problems be capitalized upon and turned into change? We'll be talking about that next. This is Syracuse Speaks on WAER.
It has taken all these years, and it took a graphic murder, literally a graphic murder, in broad daylight that has been seen by millions of people around the world, or a multitude of Americans, a multiracial coalition of Americans, to say, you know what, this is a real thing.
At the end of a long week filled with press briefings and conflicting statements, it's important to find your escape.
I would describe what I do as the art of acting perfected. Is that fair?
She wins an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress, and she says,
I did it all by myself.
WAER has programming to keep you informed, but also allows you to unplug from the news of the day. Find a full program schedule at WAER.org.
I hear a lot of people talking about the work, and a lot of people who are frustrated and angry, but I'm not seeing yet a lot of coordination to get the work that needs to be done. And I'm also tired because this is not the first time we've been in a situation very similar to this, and there was a lot of anger in those situations and a lot of people talking about work that was going to be done, and yet here we are again.
This is a special Syracuse Speaks, Protest, Policy, and Progress on Racism. And now we'd like to take a look ahead. With me on our panel today are Sam Rauser, Executive Director of On Point for College, an organization that has formally come out in favor of change and helps lift up many youth that have been victims of systemic racism. Yusuf Abdul-Qadir, director of the local NYCLU chapter, a speaker at local rallies, and someone who's been in the fight to change policies long before the current movement, and a Promised Land Church pastor, Eric Ewer, who has organized local events and helped bring together Black clergy and city officials to work on change. So as any of you look forward from this moment we're in right now, are you in any way more hopeful, optimistic, that perhaps after past movements and outcries, that in this case there's something different? Is this a moment?
It absolutely is. I think, you know, let's look at to our colleagues in Los Angeles who have said we need to defund police and talking about reallocating $150 million out of the Los Angeles Police Department and going towards reinvesting communities in sound, proven policies. You know, in Syracuse, for a budget of $252 million, we spend roughly about 20% on policing, which amounts to about $53 million. In Syracuse City Schools, we spend about $1 million towards school resource officers in schools. We don't have adequate number of counseling staff in those communities. We don't have adequate number of economic opportunities. Imagine if you know, 5% of those resources were diverted towards, you know, job opportunities for summer youth and beyond. Imagine if we provided people who are experiencing gun violence. And I want to just, Sam, you said something that really resonated with me about if you as a Black person are angry, you can't express that anger. And there's a lot to be angry about as a Black person. And in particular, as a person whose brother was killed where they grew up, I intimately appreciate some of these issues. But I had to go to school like nothing happened. Like if my brother didn't die, as if like, and I don't think people fully appreciate that when a teacher is telling you that you're not going to be anything but a drug dealer, you're not going to be anything, you're not going to amount to anything, and you're going through the emotional trauma of seeing your loved ones and your friends die on a regular basis and not have a person to go to talk about that, to help you walk through what you're experiencing, to allow you to express rage, right? And when it is expressed, the first thing that happens is you're confronted with the criminal legal system because a police officer is going to take you, he's going to arrest you, he's going to bring you, because a teacher fears and may feel themselves that their life is at risk, because it's really at risk because of their perception.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important for us to begin to rethink the role that policing has in our community, to rethink the role, the oversized role that we have in using it as a response to really what shouldn't be police responses. Police aren't mental health therapists.
Right.
They're not counselors. They're not after school program providers. Their job is to provide a particular service. And that service is necessary, perhaps, but there are plenty of other services that would necessitate a type of, I don't want to say reform, because at this point, as I said on Saturday, reform means taking a 9-inch knife out of my back and pulling it 6 inches and calling it progress. I think we need to have a transformational change in how we view and understand these issues, because it's just not been working, and we've got 401 years of evidence to show that.
So we're seeing a little bit of that. Are you guys feeling that this is a time when people might be open to that kind of, you know, big change, not minor reform?
Well, I think more and more things are going on the table in terms of what America, what people are considering. You know, COVID-19 exposed a lot of different things. You know, in particular, as you use an example of the church, we realize now the church, you know, is not necessarily defined by a building, but still the gathering of people with a message. That's a dramatic change across the church in the United States. So everything's on the table with a spirit of the necessity for change. I think that with the horrors and the shock and things that we've seen, and with the violence perpetrated, in particular with George Floyd's death, it's opened up the opportunity for us to come back to the table and have discussions about real change, real issues. Yusuf got me not wanting to use the word reform now because of the 3-inch analogy there. But there's got to be some changes. And everybody's watching now. Everybody's seem like they're mobilized for change. Shame on us if we don't use this moment and seize this opportunity to make some real radical changes for our future generation. Something dawned on me Saturday was I was standing at the rally. I was standing next to Pastor Nebraska Carter Live Water Church. He's 83 years old. And I was standing with my son. And I thought about, you know, what role can I play to help make this change? When I'm standing between somebody who could be my dad and I'm standing between my son, and I'm thinking about if he dies, you know, and with his, you know, you take away my history, if my son dies, take away my future, and they're at risk in the kind of current environment that we live in with brutality being done to Black people. So me in the middle, I've got to do something to protect my history, and I got to do something to protect my future. So I've got to be adamant about this work. So even in my message Sunday, I've been recorded, but I went live Sunday just to make the point that it's time for us to get up off of our butt. And what I mean by that is, you know, I would get involved, but I would protest, but I would call my congressman, but I would sign this petition, but you got to get off your butt and get involved, because there's never going to be another chance, probably in our lifetime. We have this opportunity while everyone is watching, everyone is open, their hearts and minds are open to make the change we need to go forward in our country.
You pastors are always good at finding that theme and then finding the different ways to look at the same theme to get your point across. President Obama said that there is a change in mindset happening. What do you think he meant?
Well, I just wanted to go back to the other thought first before we talk about President Obama. And you know, is this the time? Is this the right time?
Right. Is this a moment? Yeah.
And, you know, I used what I normally tell people, I'm 30 and a half for the second time. And I've seen these things go and go and go and go. And I'll have a clearer idea in 6 months or a year of what we've been able to accomplish, what we've been able to do. The timing is always right. It's always the right time. It's always the right moment. We have a lot of people at the table now who haven't come to the table before. And if we can diversify our efforts the way with the diversity of people, then this opportunity won't be missed.
Yeah, now is essential. I mean, I don't think we can wait any longer. I think, and it's not, and again, I don't want to distill this just to policing because it's a broader issue. This is about understanding the ecosystem that with which we live in. It's about the fact that we have housing inequality in this community. The fact that, you know, you can have a bachelor's or master's degree and be completely underemployed or underemployed. And the highest job you're going to get is a teaching assistant, right?
Ownership.
Like, ownership. Like all of these things exist and they're a part of what creates the situation whereby there is an inequity in our structures that preclude Black and brown people and other marginalized people from being successful and getting the promise that America affords all of us. And so policing is essential. It's important because it has a particular role in this particular moment, shows and highlights explicitly the problems in the institution of policing. But it's a policing exists to maintain those other structures of inequity. And so the proverbial, you know, knee on my neck is not just the physical, it's also in every sense of the word.
Right. Lots of things had to happen to get that knee on the neck. Right. Or to get to the knee on the neck.
And I mean, even for our program, I mean, we're talking to the On Point alum and we're saying, okay, what role do you want to play? And most of them are saying, you know, we want to tackle this education piece. We want to tackle this curriculum piece. Where do we start? Who do we go to? What do we have to put together? Mm-hmm. So people want to get engaged. And I've talked to other people that are interested in the economic downturn and what issues are there. They want to start businesses. They want to open up business. They need finance for it. How do we increase the number of owners in the community? You know, yeah, we do need the criminal injustice or criminal
legal system.
Yeah. Legal system reform that you have talked about. Yeah, or transformation. No, transformation that you have talked about. And that's one piece, and it's a huge piece, but we've got to be on multiple fronts, and we've got to address all of them.
Let me just ask you guys to wrap up with maybe just one final thought. If someone was listening to this and saying, I'm motivated, I've felt the energy, maybe I've been part of a march or a rally, what would you give them as 60 seconds to do, to think about, to read, to find out about?
I think the first thing is to realize and recognize that when we focus and center on quote-unquote looting, we betray the idea that we live on looted land, that we looted people from a continent to build. And I want to respect and what I appreciate about the protest this weekend is acknowledgement of the Onondaga and the Haudenosaunee, who's still here, but Indigenous people's genocide led to the necessitating of bringing Africans here to be enslaved to build this land. That doesn't exist in a vacuum, and we haven't addressed that issue. The quote-unquote original sin of America has never been done, has never been solved. And if we're going to actually truly become that pluralistic, multiracial democracy that we promised to be, that more perfect union, we have to do the hard work to make it happen. So as the pastor said, not just butt, get off your butt, and do some work and engage in these issues. There are plenty of groups who are talking about this, who are thinking about this from an intersectional perspective. As you started to allude to, the Obama administration had did a lot of reporting on this. There's already the data and information there. Anyone who is not conscious to this, in some respects, is kind of like willful ignorance, for lack of a better word, because there's been enough data out there and research and information. It's time for us to just accept that this is unfortunate, this is problematic, it's absurd, and we've got to do some work to change it.
I totally agree. I mean, this is the time now where at wherever you need to get involved, to Sam's point, you know, his alumni want to get involved in education, we need people to get involved in housing, we need people to get involved in economic reform and jobs. And being overeducated, but underutilized or underemployed, we do need police reformation as another thing. So this is the time, you know, to really put your hands where you can get to work to bring about positive change, because it is part of an ecosystem that we need to bring about change for a betterment for our people.
The first step in any recovery is admitting you have a problem. Mm-hmm. People have to admit we have a problem.
Yes.
And then we can begin to recover.
All right. Thank you very much. You've been listening to Syracuse Speaks on WAER. We've been discussing recent protests and what's going on in our community, what concrete actions might really reform police policies and other places in our community where racism is embedded and becomes a force of inequality and injustice, and what the future might hold regarding whether the energy and outrage of a community and nation will lead to change. Thanks to Pastor Eric Uhr from Promised Land Church, Yusuf Abdul-Kadir from the NYCLU, and Sam Rouser of On Point for College. Syracuse Speaks is a production of WAER, Syracuse Public Media. Production help on this episode from General Manager Joe Lee and Program and Operations Director Kevin Kloss. You can listen to this program again and find past Syracuse Speaks programs at our website, waer.org. I'm WAER News and Public Affairs Director Chris Bolt. Thanks for listening.